Spirit Radio Podcasts.
You know, Yemen is still considered to be one of the world's worst humanitarian crises in terms of what they're experiencing. And one organisation that does a lot of work in Yemen is Tear Fund, and they're connected up with different people on the ground there. It's great to have Niamh Daly, Communications Manager at Tear Fund Ireland. Niamh, we might start with that. Remind us of the current situation of what's happening in Yemen at the moment.
Yeah, so it really is. It's one of these forgotten crises, as you've mentioned there, Wendy. You know, it's gone under the radar, and I think especially so with the lack of travel and journalists and reporting being able to happen even internationally the last year because of COVID. You know, it's just not in our media that we can hear what's really going on. But, you know, even before COVID, Yemen had been described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Like, some 80% of the population requires humanitarian assistance, and there's just such lack of access to clean, safe drinking water and sanitation and hygiene. And it's all in the midst of this political crisis going on that's been tumbling on for a couple of years now at this stage. And just people's lives are getting caught up in it, and the country is really on its knees. So for agencies like Tear Fund, it is hard to get access into Yemen and to be able to help in practical ways. But we have, you know, Tear Fund is part of a bigger Tear Fund family and a network, and we have been able to work with a partner there. And although it seems small, we were able to identify about 100 households in the Sahan district. It's a governance called Sanam Governance, and can't say much more, give much more details, because it's all just very, really protected in terms of just exposing any of our partners or the people on the ground that we're helping. But one man who, obviously this isn't his real name, but we call him Ahmed for this story. You know, he's 29 years old. He has 4 children. He's moved around a bit because of the conflict, and he's now in an area that he isn't known in. So he's really, really struggling to find work. And he, as I said, he's 4 children, young ones, young, you know, toddlers, who really don't know the difference. And he, you know, for him, it was just really, really difficult that they were so running out of food, because he just couldn't find daily labour to cover the cost of providing for his family. And, you know, out in the streets, he's seeing people rummaging through the litter to try and find scraps to eat. And his fear was that his 2 young children would, he'd see them someday just trying to find something to eat. And he says that over about 3 days, you know, they cried themselves to sleep, because they didn't understand what was happening. They were just genuinely hungry. And so he is hugely grateful that he's been one of these people, his family has been one of these families who's been identified as really in dire need. And we've been able to give him a food basket on a monthly basis, and we've committed to initially 3 months, and now we've been able to extend that up to 6 months. And so he's hugely grateful for that. And so whatever additional work he can get, he can save that money, and he's hoping to pay back some of the rent that he owes. He hasn't been able to pay rent. He's living in kind of like a shop that's an unused shop area, and so it's really not set up as a home, but he's owing rent on that. So this has given him relief in lots of ways. So he has a food basket, he also has a hygiene kit in it, and he's received training around protecting them from the coronavirus. Because although the numbers are reportedly, you know, comparatively low in Yemen, it's really just because the testing facilities aren't there, and you know, the virus really is
and you're not comparing like in terms of the number of tests per head of population. Niamh, I have to say, I can't believe it's been 10 years that you've been coming on air here at Spirit Radio, and you've been working for Tear Fund for 10 years, and it's been a real privilege just how you share with us the work that Tear Fund does, but just making people aware of the various different humanitarian crises over the world. So we know you're taking up an important role elsewhere, but you might just briefly share with us some highlights just in terms of the projects that you've got to be working on as you've worked with Tear Fund over the last number of years.
Yeah, I guess, oh gosh, it's hard to pick out, you know, the highlights. I guess, when I think though, there was a trip I did, and I met Syrian refugees in the really early days of that crisis. I went to Jordan with the reporter Della Kilroy, and we were there kind of on the Syrian-Jordan border. And you know, just meeting ordinary people whose lives were in such chaos as a result of this conflict that's ongoing, still ongoing, unfortunately. But I remember driving through this area with a driver and a doctor, because our partner at the time, they used to give mums to be the taxi fares to get to the hospital, because, you know, these women may have been now delivering their second or third child, but their, you know, their first child, but they would have delivered in Syrian hospitals and, you know, in a very ordinary, you know, lifestyle that they had there. And so the thought of having their second or third child, you know, in, the, you know, really sheltering accommodation that they were now living in with only the help of their husband was terrifying for them. So our partner was helping them by giving them their taxi fare and then also paying for their hospital stay, you know, was about €8 at the time. I think the taxi fare was about 12. And so these women were hugely grateful. And one of them had delivered twins, and we were going through to try and find her to just follow up and give her some additional medical supplies. And, like, it just looked like nobody could live in this area, Wendy. Like, it was just a dust bowl, and, you know, there, you know, you really didn't think people could actually live here. And the dad was on the phone trying to direct the driver to where they were, and then out of nowhere comes this line of washing of, you know, baby's clothes, that typical, you know, the nappies and the baby grows. And you just saw life really continuing to spring up in, you know, the desperate places out of the dust. And just marvelled really at, you know, people's resilience. And
yeah, their resilience in spite of it all.
Power of hope really as well, that they could continue in this context.
Hope is something that we all need in a world that sometimes feels hopeless and tearful, and certainly provides that. Well, you might briefly as well, Niamh, before you head off, tell us about the role that's now available at Tear Fund and a little bit about who you would encourage to apply.
Yes, great opportunity. It's nice to be able to move aside and make this space available for somebody else to come into. It's been a really rewarding 10 years plus now I've had in this role. And, you know, I'd say anybody, you know, just an eye on our website and our Facebook page, and we'll soon be kind of a bit more clear as to how this role will go. But you need to have lots of energy, obviously, you know, communication skills, and just a real heart, I suppose, for the whole area of justice. And you know, if traveling overseas doesn't daunt you, and bringing people with you, leading trips, and you know, and your own personal committed Christian faith is obviously really important as well, because there's a lot of work around churches and engaging Christians around this whole area.
Well, Niamh, thank you so much for all that you've done for Tear Fund over the last number of years, for all the work you've done with us here on Spirit Radio, and we wish you every blessing in your next venture.
Thank you so much, Wendy. God bless you.
God bless you too. That's Niamh Daly, Communications Manager at Tear Fund Ireland. And as Niamh mentioned there, if you're interested in that vacancy, you can find out the details at tearfund.ie. Spirit. Evictions of people from rental accommodation has now resumed, because there was a grace period on the ban of evictions, but this period has now ended. So what sort of an impact is this going to have? Well, on the line to give us his thoughts, we've John Mark McCafferty. He's the CEO of Threshold, the national housing charity. Let's start with that, John Mark. Just give us a little bit of context. How long was this grace period in place, and what impact did it have when it was in place, and what will it have now that it's ended?
Good morning, Wendy. Yeah, look, I suppose there's a number of things from a Threshold perspective. There have been a number of eviction bans since the beginning of the COVID-19 restrictions. One was a kind of a blanket ban through till, you know, summertime of last year. And then in late summertime, a new moratorium came in, and that related to people who were in arrears directly as a result of the COVID-19 restrictions. They lost income, they lost work, they were on a pandemic unemployment payment, and they were to register with the Residential Tenancies Board as what's known as a relevant person. So they then became protected by a particular eviction ban. That continues right through till June of this year. It's been extended out to June, but it is a very small number of people who are covered by that ban, because you have to, if not only are you in arrears, but your arrears have to be linked to a loss of income due to the COVID-19 restrictions. Plus, you have to register as a relevant person with the Residential Tenancies Board. So there are only hundreds of private renters in that category. What also happened then, towards the end of last year, as we moved to the 5K restriction through legislation, the 5K restriction triggered a blanket ban again. And what we found is, you know, with the welcome relaxation of the 5K, what also accompanied that was the fall in that particular ban. So it means that the only people now covered by any kind of moratorium in the private rented sector are people who fulfill those two criteria that I just mentioned. So it means that from last Friday, evictions can be served where they were live sometime last year, or where a landlord is intending to finish a tenancy for a whole range of reasons. Now, I guess why it's important is because the main issue that people contact Threshold, the National Housing Organisation, is because they want to seek advice, and they often want their tenancy protected because they're worried about losing their home due to the spectre of the end of a tenancy arising because they're getting a notice of termination from their landlord. And I think that's why it's relevant. It's relevant because it is the main issue which people come to us with regard to. And often at the end of a notice of termination, people can lose their home. Now, they don't own the home, they rent the home, but they may have been renting it for 10 years, 20 years, they may have been renting it for 1 year.
And do you have any additional rights if you have been renting it for a longer period of time?
The main thing there is about your notice period. That if the notice is valid, if it's a legal notice, a valid notice, you will lose your home. It's just that you will have a longer notice period, so you will have a longer period with which to source alternative housing. But as we know, the supply of housing is very, very low. The rent levels continue to be high, regardless of COVID-19.
So what's your suggestion, Jean-Marc, in terms of what should be happening? Bearing in mind, obviously, you're trying to balance the rights of those in the rental accommodation who don't want to lose their homes, but also the property owner, too, who needs to, you know, especially if they just own one or two properties, you know, they're trying to pay bills and mortgages and balancing those rights. How should that work going forward, given that we're still very much in this pandemic?
Yeah, look, it's a delicate balancing act, and we've fully recognised it's a landlord's property. It's also a tenant's home. So the legislation around tenants and landlords' rights and responsibilities are detailed, they're complex, because of that delicate balance between the two. I suppose for us, a number of things. One, greater supply of housing more generally, and in particular social housing, because many people are inappropriately housed in the private rented sector when really in other jurisdictions they would be in some form of social housing. That's one thing. I guess secondly, many people lose their homes through absolutely no fault of their own, and that might be through a landlord selling up, or a landlord's family member moving in, or where a tenant comes to the end of what's known as a Part 4 tenancy. So at the end of 6 years, the tenancy kind of ends, and it's up to the landlord whether that's renewed. So there are a number of points at which a tenant can lose their home, even though they have fulfilled all of the requirements of the tenancy. So I guess we are advocating for stronger security of tenure for tenants, fully recognising that there are rights also for the landlords as the property holder. And I think what we'd be looking for in coming legislation later this year is for a move towards indefinite tenancies. So we're encouraging landlords to take on tenancies for a longer period, because more of us are renting in the private rented sector, and more of us are spending more of our lives, and families are forming and growing up and aging in the private rented sector. The owner occupation is no longer the default. While it's still in the majority, it is in the decline. And so more families than individuals are living in the private rented sector
needs to be looked at that change as there's more protections, for example, in other European countries. We'll have to leave it there. There's John Mark McCaffrey, the CEO of Threshold, the national housing charity. If you are in difficulty or you're seeking advice, you can go to their website, threshold.ie. Spirit. Well, are you someone who would like to see outdoor dining resume by the end of May? And what about indoor dining? Well, you're not alone, because according to an Amoric research poll, 77% of people agree with that outdoor dining should resume by the end of May. It is a sector in terms of the hospitality sector. It employs 180,000 people, and it's been shut down like many other industries for the best part of a year. So how are restaurants coping? Well, on the line to share with us a little bit of his thoughts and experiences, we have Chef Mate Wade Murphy, who is the co-owner and head chef of restaurant 1826 Adair in Limerick. Wade, it's something like over 40 weeks of the past 52 that your restaurant has been closed. How have you been coping?
Yeah, it's been strange. Yeah, I've stopped counting, actually. Wendy, we've been closed so much, but look, I've been keeping busy with Rian. He's nearly three now, so at least I have that, and I've been just kind of trying to look for the silver linings, you know, and spend time with the family, do things at home. We're building a house as well, which is crazy, so I add that stress to it all as well. But look, it's kept us busy and kept us doing stuff and stuff like that. So we've been doing the takeaway 1826 of Walia once a month, or on special occasions like Easter and stuff like that. So we're doing it this weekend, the bank holiday weekend. So we're just about to head into work to start prepping for that, myself and Elaine, doing it ourselves, you know. So yeah, just trying to keep busy and trying to stay positive.
And you know,
I've stopped listening to the noise.
Yeah, and yourself and Elaine, I mean, as owners of this restaurant, you're not just responsible for yourself and for Rian, you've got staff to think about, local suppliers that you would have been working with that they would have been impacted by. At this stage, have you had any roadmap or clarity, you know, from the government saying, look, here's what's going to happen?
No, there is none. And, you know, I've, as I said to you just a minute ago, I've stopped listening to the noise and the rumours, because it's just getting very frustrating, all the leaks, the rumours, or they say, he said, she said, could be May. Like this morning, from what I gather, it's outdoor dining from the end of May, and hopefully, fingers crossed, indoor dining from end of June, early July. But you see, it's not just as simple as that as well. Like, you know, and then I'm lucky, I have a back garden and a front garden in 1826, and there's people who have no outdoor spaces, you know, so
it depends on the restaurant. And then there's other restaurants, Wade, who I imagine you did some of this, invested a lot of money in creating outdoor spaces or changing your indoor space to kind of suit social distancing and all that sort of stuff, but you haven't really had a chance to make that money back.
No, none whatsoever for the few weeks that we have been open. Like, it was a lot of money spent. There are supports out there, minimum supports. I think the supports need to be a lot more. The CRSS doubled and stuff like that. And there are certain supports, but it's not enough. Like, there will be many, many, many restaurants who won't open their doors again. And, you know, it's all well and good us all talking about, oh, open up restaurants, open up outdoor. You know, what restrictions as well, and what are you opening to? There's all that to be considered. It's not just as simple as turning the key and open it and they will come. You know, there are places that will be busy. I'm sure we will be busy when we open back up. But then, what will be the limit? Will it be 15 people outdoors? Will it be, you know, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, within the absence of kind of clarity, it's very hard for you to plan ahead.
Yeah, you can't plan.
Do you feel at this point, Wade, you've been closed for such a long time? I know there was a piece of research a few weeks ago just talking about something like 0.01% of cases were attributed to outdoors, not outdoor dining, but outdoor settings in particular, spaces. Do you feel that the response and the length of the time you've had to be closed, is it proportionate, or how are you feeling about it?
No, I don't think it is proportionate. I think everybody's trying their best to survive and come out of this and you know, do what they can. Like, as I said to you, for me, I've just stopped listening to the noise, Wendy. I'm stopped listening to the rumours, because it'll only just torment you. And even people, I know places that are serving food and letting people sit outside the premises and stuff like that already, and have been doing it. And look, I'm not going to get frustrated with that, and I'm not going to start giving out about that. I can understand why some people have, but like, I don't want to go to a dark place, and I will if I start getting too involved with this. And
yeah, you're trying to stay positive, so have you hope for the summer then?
Yeah, I hope so. Like, I hope we get open. I hope, again, I'm hoping the restrictions won't be too harsh. And, you know, like, when we opened last year, even the little bit of time we were open, we were only operating at 40% of what we would have normally operated at. So it's not just as simple as open it up, you know, it's what will the restrictions be? How much are we going to have to invest again to open with the guidelines and everything like that? So it's really, really up. It's up in the air, and there is no guidance. And I'm sick of the leaks. I'm sick of, you know, all of this, and I'm not listening to them. Like, as somebody said to me last week, do you have any idea when you'll be open? I said, when there's an announcement, you'll know and I'll know.
Yeah,
that's it,
you're not kept in the loop at all, which I imagine only adds to the frustration and the stress that you're feeling, Wadewell.
There is lots of, like, the Restaurant Association of Ireland and everything, they really are campaigning and lobbying, really hard on behalf of restaurants. I have to hold my hat off to them and take my hat off to them. They are trying their best, but they're getting no information themselves.
Spirit. If you've ever had a dog, you will know how special the bond between owner and dog can be. And I know certainly when I was growing up, the dog in our house really was part of the family. Well, our next guest is the press coordinator for the Top Dog Film Festival, and they're going to share with us a little bit about what's in store. It's great to have with us Rosie Fuller. First of all, Rosie, we might start off, just tell us a little bit about the festival and what people can expect.
Hello, yes, so it's a collection of short films, as you said, all celebrating the amazing bond between humans and their dogs, and just celebrating our fantastic four-legged friends in general. So we've got all sorts of dogs. We've got medical dogs, so these are dogs who, in a film this is, they're dogs who are kind of either cancer detection dogs or diabetes detection dogs. And that film also visits a doggy blood bank where dogs can donate blood to help other dogs in need. So that's kind of a really heartwarming and interesting film, you know, with a lot of scientific emphasis. And then we've got some more sort of adventurous dogs who like surfing and mountain biking and travelling. So it's just a whole spectrum of wonderful dog films from around the world.
And give us a bit more of an example. There was one that caught my eye, Paws and Wheels. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh yeah, so that's a lovely film, and it's about a mountain biker, a really good, you know, a professional mountain biker who takes his lovely dog Baloo with him everywhere he goes mountain biking. And it kind of explores the bond that you can have when you share your hobby with your pet, which I'm sure loads and loads of dog owners will experience regardless of whether you're a professional mountain biker or you just take your dog along, whatever your hobby is. But yeah, it's a lovely film that really explores that, and the kind of scenery and the camera work as well is amazing. And Baloo's just adorable. So yeah, that's a lovely film.
Yeah, he sounds lovely. And from these films, Rosie, do you think it's one of the aims is just that bond and how incredible dogs are and the bond that they can have with humans?
Yeah, for sure. Yes. And I think, you know, during lockdown, we've all sort of, everyone with a dog has experienced that even more than usual. And the bond's already incredible. But, you know, how strong it can be and how much it can improve our sort of mental health and our physical health, and, you know, just makes life better in general, doesn't it, I think, to have dogs around.
So who do you think will enjoy these films? Is there something for all ages?
Yeah, something for all ages. If you're a young animal lover, we've got a kind of backstage zone with a kids area as well for more things that young animal lovers can get up to. But yeah, all ages. And if you haven't got a dog but you just love animals, it would be a great festival for you as well.
Sounds like a lovely distraction, which is what we all need at the moment. That's Rosie Fuller, press coordinator from the Top Dog Film Festival. The Top Dog Film Festival starts this Friday, that's the 30th of April, and viewing for watching these short films is open for 72 hours, and you get a virtual pass which gets you into the backstage zone and a kids zone for young animal lovers as well. You can go to the website topdogfilmfestival.co.uk for all the information on that. Spirit. Well, my next guest has come to the rescue of parents by running a cool series of YouTube videos with lots of great ideas for play at home, especially aimed at small children. Now she's decided to offer a free webinar. Tomorrow it's going to be happening. It's called Surviving at Home with the Toddler. It's great to have with us Marge Smith, who's co-director of Really Cool After School and Montessori School in North Dublin. I think, Marge, a lot of people will identify with this thing of, yes, some days I feel like I'm just surviving. So what's your advice to parents who are feeling like that today at home with their toddlers?
Hi, Wendy. Yes, I'm a mother of a toddler myself, and that's why we created this help for parents to help them to survive at home with a toddler. Because, as you said, sometimes it actually feels like just surviving. And our idea for the webinar is to give parents the communication tools, because sometimes it just takes a little hack, you know, a little change in your communication, in the way you word your things, how you talk to your toddler, so they will actually listen. The YouTube videos that you mentioned earlier were focusing on activities for the children, but this webinar focuses on a positive discipline that we are promoting when working with our parents. So on the webinar, we'll be giving parents tips and advice how to change their communication and to help them, you know, to talk to the toddlers so they'll actually do what they want them to do.
So what is positive discipline then? Because I think it's something that parents struggle with, Marge.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You see, we got a lot of phone calls and messages from parents saying that, especially now during the lockdowns, when they're at home a lot and they're trying to juggle work life together with parenting, parents very often say that they feel guilty because they will snap at their children or they will shout or, you know, they don't know what to do and how to discipline them, how to get the kids to do what they want them to do. So positive discipline actually focuses on finding those solutions in a guilt-free way, so the parents feel good about themselves because they learn the techniques that help them to get the kids to do what they want them to do, but it happens without the punishment, without the shouting, without the yelling, and it's like a stress-free environment, which is better for everybody, for the children and for the parents.
Oh, obviously. That sounds good. How do I stop shouting and yelling this afternoon when I've asked my toddler to do something for the 10th time and they're not listening and everyone's frustrated?
Wendy, join our webinar tomorrow. I will tell you all the secrets.
Great stuff. So what can people expect? We'll be hearing about positive discipline. What else can people expect from the webinar?
Yes, tomorrow we're going to focus on communication. So we're going to give them lots of different tips of how to change your sentence structure and how to talk to kids so they actually hear you. And as you said, they do what you want them to do at the first time. There are little tiny hacks that we can all put into practice straight away after the webinar and see if they work.
Sounds good to me. And Marge, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Marge Smith, the co-director of Really Cool After School and Montessori. If you want to get in touch and you want to watch that webinar, it takes place tomorrow. That's Wednesday, the 28th of April at 1 o'clock. And you can find out more on the Really Cool After School Facebook and Instagram pages.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.